Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Jane Bloom. On this program, we talk to people at the University of New Mexico who do very interesting things. And today is no exception. I have with me Professor Gerald Visner. He is a distinguished professor of American Studies at UNM. He also teaches up in Santa Fe as visiting professor in the Department of Indigenous Liberal Studies at the Institute of American Indian Arts.
That's correct.
And you've been at UNM 7 years, you told me.
Yes.
And you came to UNM after a distinguished career at the University of California at Berkeley.
That's correct. Yes. I retired from the American Studies Department and retired here. But as you can see, I'm not retired yet.
Not quite. What attracted you to come to New Mexico?
Oh, friends here for 30, 40 years and visiting often, and a lively literary and art community, and affordable.
All of that.
Yes.
Well, speaking of literary and art community, I want to point out to our listeners that in terms of your work, you are a literary man. You are a Renaissance man. You are a prolific writer. You have written virtually everything from novels to screenplays to science fiction to poetry. You write haiku poetry. We'll get to that in a minute. You are a true – you've even been a photographer. You've been a journalist, newspaper reporter.
That suggests a very old man doing so many things. I can hardly remember doing some of these things. I just keep working and publishing books, and after a while I had a lot of books in print.
So what inspires that prodigious literary output?
Probably a combination of fighting for a presence of natives in literature rather than an absence, and perhaps some controlled rage about the history and bad victimary literature that most people read about native literature, about natives and their literature.
And I would like to point out to our audience that you are an enrolled member of the Chippewa tribe.
Yes.
The White Earth Reservation
uh-huh.
In Minnesota.
Yes, we've changed the language a bit. I don't want to go into the new constitution, which I worked on as a delegate. But
maybe we should.
Just to say that we've gotten away from enrolled member, it sounds like a country club, into the word citizen of a nation, of a dependent nation right. In the United States. And that's a more admirable and a better feeling description.
You have, I would have to say, a mixed background in the sense that I think your father was the Anishinaabe.
Yes. This is a I sit here benefiting from a premier union of the French fur trade and the Anishinaabe. And that started in the 18th century and ran for a long time. And the French who were involved in the fur trade seemed to like the native way of life because they intermarried frequently with Anishinaabe and stayed. Most of the surnames on the White Earth Reservation are French.
So is Visner a French surname?
Yes. It's been changed, but its origin was French.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could have identified either with the – in New Mexico we call it the Anglo side or the Native American side. And where does that identification come from, do you think?
Well, it comes from family experience and who I lived with and where I lived and the people I identify with. There weren't French communities around. There were only Anishinaabe, and those communities were mostly mixed with the French fur trade history.
And you had a tragedy in your family. Your father was killed mysteriously when you were very small, and he was
yes.
The Anishinaabe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. He was quite young. I lived with my grandmother, returned to the reservation. And then some years later, I have no memory of that, but from recollection with relatives, it was 2 or 3 years later we came back to the city, and I've been back and forth between Northern Minnesota and Minneapolis.
I would like to point out that there's a book I've read of yours, Shrouds of White Earth.
Yes.
Where the narrator, who is supposedly talking to you as the interlocutor who wants to write a biography, and mm-hmm. he's an artist, he's a painter, begins to talk about your father's murder
mm-hmm.
and actually speculates on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a reflection of your belief.
Yes,
what happened to him, because this mm-hmm. is an interesting story.
Mm-hmm. My father and the whole family came to the city for work, as did thousands and thousands of natives. Maybe that was the first serious wave during the Great Depression in the mid and late 30s. The second great migration period would have been the Second World War. But people looking for work and found working for contractors. And I suppose you could say they were something of immigrant labor. Obviously citizens and from reservations, but still they were cheap labor. And
your father became active in the labor union movement.
Yes, he did, with some cousins and with his brothers.
Right.
And two of the Visner boys were murdered within 2 weeks of each other. And it's likely related to the very violent history of that time, where the city of Minneapolis was the city conspired. The politicians conspired with the police and the organized criminals in the city to eliminate active people in the union protest, assuming they were communists and socialists and therefore anti-American.
Well, you know, a similar thing happened with Fidel Castro. Our government conspired with mobsters to try to eliminate Castro.
I agree with your point, but I don't find the analogy pertinent to Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis.
Maybe not, but that's what—
They were not communists. They were not socialists. They were citizens of the United States struggling in a trucker strike for better wages to deliver produce. And the city and the owners conspired with the police and organized crime to stop that strike. During that period, say that decade, there were something like 30 unsolved homicides. Many people think they were all associated with organized crime. Kid Can was the principal figure at that time in organized crime.
Ironically, he was a Jewish mobster.
Mm-hmm. Lived in, grew up not far from the areas I worked in when I was a young adult, a poverty area.
So I want to hearken back to the controlled rage and Native American presence in literature, but I want to remind our audience that this is University Showcase, and I'm talking with Professor Gerald Visner. He's a distinguished professor of American Studies at UNM, and a citizen, if you want to call that, of the Chippewa Nation, the Anishinaabe.
I appreciate that shift, yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, you have a language in mind, and I want to get to that. You want to have Native American presence in literature.
Let's talk about that. Not
yeah,
only
I
literature
do want
and
to
history.
Talk about,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do want to talk about that. And you, one of the words you've coined to talk about and to promote is the concept of survivance.
Yes.
Not survival.
No.
Not surviving.
No.
But survivance.
Yes.
What is your concept of what survivance means?
Well, simply it's a construction of the word survival with a condition or a quality, an anse, a practice, an action, not just a passive response. The word existed in French in the 18th century, moved into English,
mm-hmm.
19th century, and then wasn't used very much in I didn't create the word. I just brought it back into usage with a special condition and definition that natives and others who struggle do so with resistance and a spirit, and that's survivance, not just mere survival.
And one of the things I believe that you're saying is one of the ways to reflect that is to write.
Yes.
And call things to people's attention.
Yes, to change the assumption, popular cultural assumption, that natives are an absence in history. And to show how that works, you only have to think of the metaphor of the vanishing Indian. And also that almost all references to natives in history and literature is victimry.
That's another word. You don't say victimization. No. You say victimry. Mm-hmm. What is the concept of victimry?
Well, it's the literature and history that encourages the idea that natives have been victims only, and therefore it's a culture of victimry. Hardly. It's a culture of survivance, not of victimry. Only the people who dominate the literature and history of natives would make it victimry because it's marketable. Natives have been working for a couple of generations to write a history of presence and a literature of survivance.
One of the tenets that you have is that one way to fight victimry is to use irony.
Well, I would say there are only a few cultures in the world that don't have a recognizable irony. The United States may be, because of its complexity of language sources, one of the most ironic, or at least there's great potential for irony in the English language. So I'm just recognizing what exists already in the language, and we can see it in the metaphors and promises made by politicians. We can see it in the irony of commercial literature, that editors and writers produce a literature that has commercial value rather than a value of survivance. That's ironic.
You talk about in this book that I read, The Shrouds of White Earth, Gerald Visner, which I would recommend to anyone who's not familiar with your work, because all the themes that you've been concerned about in your writing appear in this book.
They do indeed, yes.
That's one I would recommend.
And it just won the American Book Award, so that's another good reason to read it.
As a matter of fact, one of the things you write about, one of the things your narrator says to you, the interlocutor, is that you write stories not to escape, but to evade the tiresome politics of native victimry.
Yes.
What is it? What are the tiresome politics?
Well, it's as simple as the use of invented names. Indian, for instance. Navajo is a Spanish word.
Mm-hmm.
Flathead is somebody's description.
Yes.
Chippewa is complicated history, but it's not Anishinaabe. It's the invention of this language and establishing it so well in ordinary discussions that you either have to argue in every phrase or go along with it. And if you go along with it, you have entered a language game and therefore the instinct for good irony.
One of the things that the narrator in Shrouds of White Earth and you have in common is that you don't produce what might be considered traditional Native American work.
No, not many Native artists do. It's I think there's a popular view that Natives are very good at representations of cultural things. I mean, I think
basketry, beadwork,
yeah, like
Navajo woven rugs, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that is popular and very commercial. But contemporary Native artists are way ahead of anybody's expectation. In fact, I argue that Natives anticipated many art movements in the world. And they were untutored artists when they did it.
Such as? Which ones?
Well, you think of the ledger artists who have multicolored horses and they're suspended in space.
Like one of your heroes, Marc Chagall.
Yes, it's visionary art. And yes. So I would say Marc Chagall and legendary artists imagined and had a visionary sense of this kind of artistic presentation long before the movements that define it.
For those who might not be familiar with ledger art, as I understand it, it was almost on school books.
On ledger books. Government ledger books.
Natives, unfortunately, were gathered together by the government off their...
These were political prisoners at primarily Fort Marion, Florida.
Yes.
But natives have painted on hides and other substances similar images long before the ledger art. It's just that for most people, the ledger art is so familiar.
And I sense also that you argue that if you stay with what could be considered traditional art, are you perpetuating victimry? Is this?
Oh, no, not at all. The people who perpetuate victimry invested in the art object as if it's the only one and must be the treasure of a museum. When what was early traditional art always did change, it was used, it had practical value.
It had utility.
Utility.
Yeah.
And it was ephemeral in many ways. I only have to point out the simplest and maybe the most dramatic at the same time example, and that's the Hatali or Navajo healers who sand paint. Beautiful, incredible, magnificent paintings.
But they're meant to be ephemeral.
They are. And you brush them aside when you're done with the ceremony. However, people like to freeze them and frame them and capture them and possess them as a cultural object.
What are your thoughts about the ability of survivance, the quality of survivance, if people choose to remain on the reservation?
Well, I don't think people make political choices like that.
I never wanted to imply that it was a political choice.
No, but it's people don't exactly decide to stay or leave. There are conditions that are incentives or maybe disincentives, and people have good reasons to do things to enrich their lives, to gain other experiences. And the United States ought to be grateful for that rather than finding it a fault, because in disproportionate numbers, Native Americans served in all the wars of this country, starting with the Civil War, First World War, Second World War, maybe 45,000 Natives in the Second World War.
And in New Mexico, we are constantly reminded of the Navajo Code Talkers.
Yes. They were active mostly in the South Pacific, but in the First World War, the Choctaw were active in Europe. Remember, it was just the beginning of radio, so their communications were by telephone lines in the trenches. But also during the Second World War, Choctaw, Cherokee, Creek, Chippewa, and Navajo practiced various aspects of code languages derived from their own languages in Europe and in the South Pacific.
That may be an untold story about the other nations who participated.
It's not as extensive as the Navajos, and also because the Navajos were in service in larger numbers and were mostly active in those dreadful island campaigns in the South Pacific. So they came to more notice, and they had a stronger veterans organization.
Who could lobby for them?
I wouldn't say lobby. I would say recognize and celebrate their great achievement and their service.
You had military service also.
Yes.
And fascinatingly enough, one of the reason that you write haiku poetry
is because
of having been exposed to Japanese culture.
Yes.
And you served there in the 1950s during the Korean War. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
So at that time,
at the end, right at the end of the Korean War,
and the Japanese nation at that time was probably still struggling to recover from the effects of World War II.
Yes, very serious struggle. Mm-hmm.
So, what was it about Japanese culture that resonated with you? Was it because you were 23-year-old young impressionable soldier?
I was 18, actually.
18, yeah. Actually. A young impressionable soldier, or was it something else, or both?
Well, I have the advantage of trying to interpret my own impressions and experiences, but I can say they came very fast and with great enthusiasm and excitement. So I choose a few things to mention as inspirational. One, of course, is the literature. I just connected with imagistic poetry immediately. And I could even learn to translate some of it because it is so direct, subtle but so direct. That was a discovery of not only the imagistic power of language, which I did understand but not very well in Native or Anishinaabe dream songs, which are imagistic. A difference that I won't go into at the moment, but so a little bit of feeling about that, but not so fully dramatic as this great imagistic literature of Japan. Also the fact that ordinary people knew the literature of their nation. I didn't know that. I mean two nations, the Anishinaabe and the United States. I had to study Milton and Chaucer and Shakespeare, great literary artists, of course, but it's not the literature of my experience, my nation, doubly. But the Japanese, everyone understood and could even quote and appreciate the great literature of their imagistic poets.
I think it's true of people in Russia.
It may be,
yes. Very, mm-hmm. They're very enamored of their poetry.
That's right.
Do you have in the front of your brain any haiku poems that you might want to share with our listeners?
They don't work well in this context or this media because they require some gesture either by the page, you know, the words on the page, or by the presence of the person stating them. And this is a kind of silent listening here. I don't think they work very well in this way. Imagistic work should be on the page or maybe said several times. I could tell you one lovely, ironic one.
Please.
I was invited as a poet to participate in a small town or community poetry program and did so and went into a restaurant and it was being filmed. Film was produced. And this small cafe gave us permission to sit, about 15 of us, you know, a crew. And I ordered a piece of pie and coffee, and so did everybody else. And this was a family cafe in Ellsworth, Wisconsin, mother, father, and daughter. And I asked the daughter, if I were to recite a poem, would you just react immediately to the way you feel about it? And she looked to her parents for permission and agreed. So I said, "Fat green flies square dance across the grapefruit. Honor your partner." And she looked at me and said, "That ain't what we do with flies around here, mister." So there's a cultural difference.
Very definitely.
Issa, Basho, Japanese images, poets would have found that a great image. To honor your partner, the flies who are dancing on the grapefruit that you're about to eat. And the image is a square dance, so they should be dancing.
That's wonderful. Given your fascination and love of the Japanese haiku poetry, and I'm sure a lot of other aspects of Japanese culture, I wonder how – what your thoughts are about our having dropped those atomic bombs on Japan.
That's not a question for a short interview, of course, but I appreciate your very serious reminder of this nuclear destruction of two cities that has changed the entire world and all of our lives. It's changed our government. It's changed the way in which we look upon an executive office. They now have secret powers that was never granted to them in the Constitution. So much secrecy that our entire constitutional representative government has been changed from its original purposes. And other countries too. The Cold War probably would have gone on anyway, but its potential disaster has affected all of our lives. On the other hand, we must say that these two great powers in the world didn't annihilate each other, and the bomb has never been used again. I teach a course on this subject at the university, and my approach is to bring the students to understand the political, military, and scientific interests in developing this weapon, and then its use. At the end of the course, the last 2 or 3 weeks, we're approaching that right now, we read the literature and translation of three of the survivors. They were writers in Hiroshima who survived, and they could do nothing in the rest of their life but write about their experience in Hiroshima.
Their survivance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, their survivance.
It's been fascinating talking with you. I've enjoyed it tremendously. Our guest today on University Showcase has been Gerald Visner, Distinguished Professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, prolific author. If you've never read any of his books, I recommend you start with Shrouds of White Earth. Thank you for being here. I wish you well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Copies of this and other University Showcase programs are available. All you have to do is call 277-4516, 277-4516, or listen to our podcast at KUNM.org. The executive producer of University Showcase is Dick Fredrickson. Our recording engineer is Roman Garcia. I'm your host, Jane Bloom. Thank you for listening to University Showcase.